Confusion.
What did he say? It was like a 40% penetration in terms of people on the ground in companies that might be making decisions. Did they have access to the information they needed? It was only 40%. And I think that what that tells you is you can have all the tools you like, but if they're not proving useful to people, they're not really going to use them.
Come up for air, have a look around at what's going on, and look and go, oh my God, it's still fucking dashboards. And what was it in 2002? Dashboards. And I had my issues with dashboards in 2002, and I have my issues with them now.
The confusion matrix. Confusion.
Let's do this. We are rolling. Hello, Pete. How are you today?
I'm very good, Alex. How are you doing?
I'm really, really, really irritable. And I wasn't earlier on. And I blame it all on technology. And I particularly blame it on my Mac this morning. I think I'm being sort of slightly unfair there. But nothing seems to be working. Things that were working yesterday aren't working today. Things that should be working are not working. And it's quite incredible how quickly you go from a zen-like calm state to literally wanting to rip the screen off and smash it repeatedly against the wall in utter frustration. Do you ever get that?
Yeah, that's the time I need to get up and go for a quick walk the dog.
Well, I'm not going to walk the dog. I'll tell you what I'm going to do, Pete. I'll tell you, I'm going to record a podcast. So we'll have to see. Maybe we'll have to like pause this midway and I'll have to go out for a calming walk in the Scottish countryside.
Yes.
Or maybe, you know, given my curse of technology today, that Descript, which is what we're using to record this, will flip out on us as well. So maybe I shouldn't just touch anything from here on, because I might just curse it. Anyway, right, enough of my complaining. The act of me complaining for the first 5 minutes of the podcast seems to be a bit of a feature now. I should tell that. Right, what are we going to talk about today? Not my problems. We're going to talk about business intelligence.
Woohoo!
Oh, good God, I hate it. But we're going to do it, right? We're going to do it. We're going to knuckle down and do this, Pete. So why are we doing this? We're doing this while it's been bubbling under the surface. It peaks its dirty little head out every now and again in our conversations. It's unavoidable when you do what we do, but this particular desire to kick this off was triggered by a podcast episode on Data Framed with a gentleman called Howard Dresner, who is credited with having created the term business intelligence in the 1980s. I actually really found him quite charming and quite insightful in an interview on Data Framed, which I will put in the show notes, a link to that. We both listened to that, and so he gave me lots of feels. Generally, he made me feel almost warm and fuzzy about BI, which is very, very unusual thing, right? That alone warrants a conversation, but also left me with about as many questions as he answered. A good sort of state of the union as far as BI was concerned. So I quite appreciated it, but I now immediately stopped listening to that episode and went, I have to talk about this. It like needs to come out like as an almost urgent desire. And so here we are, probably about 2 weeks after I initially listened to it, but better late than never. What were your initial feelings having listened to this, Pete?
Yeah, well, I was the same. I thought he was very eloquent and talked about it. And his basis was like a survey that his company puts out every year. And they've been doing it, I don't know, did he say 16 years plus, and he's been in the industry X many years. And so what I found quite, like you said, charming was he's been at it longer than we have. And he was sort of lightheartedly disappointed with it, which is quite funny, which we'll go into. But also, I like some of the historical terms that he brought out. You know, he's talking about how he used to be management information systems, you know? You know, yes. One of those terms suddenly chimes in your head and you go, oh, yeah, I remember that.
Well, okay, so since you say that, so let I'm sure we'll discuss the various bits of pieces that came out of that, not least the adoption stuff, which we'll come back to. But I think, you know, a couple of things first. Let's just do what do we mean by business intelligence? And then we're going to rewind back in history to the dark days of MIS. So firstly, what do we mean? Do you want to go on? Give it a go, Pete. Give it a go. Tell us what BI is. Well,
that's what it says on the tin, right? It's information, key information that you need to run your business or that comes out of your business. And it plugs into decision-making. I mean, quite simply, that's what it should be.
Well, the decision-making information systems, right? And in fact, funny enough, management information systems is far more descriptive than business intelligence, right? But, and I think just to be clear, what we're talking about here in the current landscape is MS, Power BI, Tableau, ClickView, those things, right?
Yeah.
We'll go through some of the key players a bit later. But ultimately, whereas something like Excel, monolithic spreadsheets, you can share them around people, they get wielded like a BI tool, but essentially they're just an individual productivity accounting document tool thing. What business intelligence is supposed to be is distributed. Right. So it's distributed information and decision-making systems. What most people equate BI with is dashboards, right? Usually on Power BI. It's really about empowering the greater number of users to make decisions about their jobs on a day-to-day basis and to understand performance of their, you know, department or company or whatever it is. This is distinct from sort of accounting systems, which are usually sort of wrapped up with horrific ERP, gargantuan horror shows. That's entirely different. This is sort of the commercial edge of this type of commercial and operational edge of reporting.
Yeah. I mean, what I find interesting there, just as a little aside, is, and he mentioned the same, you know, that quite often you have finance at the top there if you're in a, you know, a big company. And that's, I think, when you think about it, it's because finance is reporting on numbers, which, you know, are key to the company, you know, usually sales and costs and that sort of stuff, which are themselves, you know, management information. So it's almost like the definition of a large part of finance. It is, you know, BI. But because they focus very specifically on financials, and those financials also have very specific definitions from the accounting side of things. So, you know, your gross profit, profit after tax, et cetera, et cetera. And so the focus is always on that. And I think if that was there, you know, that's been there way longer than any business information. And it's almost, and it's not quite like this, but it's almost like business intelligence has borrowed from that. And it's saying, okay, well, we can talk about other things that we do in numbers, and that's quite useful. And so there's always this sort of large overlap. And I think from afar, people think, oh, yeah, they're just the same thing. And this is where, you know, straight away it rolls into a problem, because you can look at it and go, oh, well, business venture is just like finance, but a bit different. But certainly I know our experience dealing with finance is that they're always, as they should be, very focused on the finance side of things. And that's not always what you need when you are making other decisions and you're trying to build up other information. And so I think there's a large overlap there, but they're definitely not the same.
Well, so I think firstly, you know, you can distribute finance data. via BI. You can distribute like operations, manufacturing data, all of this. I think, especially given our background, we're more likely to see sort of sales or marketing information through it. But I think the sort of key difference here is the periodicity in that the reason you know your P&L is because everyone stopped and drew a line under a financial year or a quarter or whatever that is and did the calculations. And you might be keeping a log of margin, for example, or a profit as you go along. But until, you know, your financials have been done, you don't know what your gross margin is or your net margin or anything like that. It's stuff that has to go through a whole bunch of procedures and it includes accounting for tax and things like that, right? So all of that mad stuff that we keep away from that's not really relevant to the day-to-day running of the business. So, you know, it's the regular cadence, intermediate sort of day-to-day running of the business type data that tends to get shown through BI systems. But I think we should be clear, any data that you want to visualize and distribute, you know, in tables and charts can go through BI systems. I think the other focus is, I mean, we can sort of zoom out as that the systems themselves aren't necessarily limited to this. It's just what they're optimized for, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, some of the items you mentioned there in terms of finance is also where the drawbacks start to come. Like you say, you know, you've got specified periodicity like quarters and year end. And, you know, those things are defined by finance. And I mean, some of the good things there is that's defined. And so you've got that period and then, you know, you have to report by that date, you know, if you're on the stock market and all that sort of thing, you know you have to report by then, otherwise you get fined. And so that really brings in quite a nice discipline, which I think is sometimes lacking on the more BI side, where if you get the number wrong, well, no one's that sure in the first place, you know. We'll come on to that, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, you mean rigor and accuracy, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so yes indeed. So Let's just rewind. Let's get in our DeLorean and zoom up to whatever that is, 78 miles an hour. And we're going to go back in time. I'm going to recount some of my dark days of earliest exposure to BI or MIS, as it was called then, which is around the year, let's call it, 2002, when I worked for a company that you might have heard of called lastminute.com. And somehow landed myself a job as a Perl developer in their MIS team. And I have absolutely no idea how this happened, but it did. And we were using, we were using homegrown systems at that point, which is mad. Me and this guy, Jeremy, were building stuff in Perl that did the reporting for them. And then we had like digital analytics was log file analytics. So we had to ship off the log files for the website every day and they'd come back processed with data. And so at that point I did one of the first of European implementations of Omniture, which later became Adobe Analytics. So, this is right at the early days. And obviously my focus very digital. So I ended up managing that team. And there was a few acquisitions along the way of other companies. There's a sort of a big hazy blob between me churning out dodgy Perl code, and suddenly in my mind I've moved buildings and I've got business objects and Omniture right under a team of like 20 people or something. that do that stuff, that manage those systems and a set and some big old reporting databases. And I was managing a team doing that, right? So like, I was in charge of it for lastminute.com at their height. And now I think about this, I'm like, what the fuck? What? I mean, how did that happen? I didn't know what business objects did. I think my trajectory was I was in charge of the Omniture stuff. So I was in charge of digital analytics and somehow ended up managing the whole team. And then someone told me, oh, that's business objects as well, mate. Right. And I was like, oh, shit. And I had also, because we'd acquired some other company, I can't even remember who that was. Might have been, I don't know, another online travel company. They had Cognos, which was all about the data.
Oh, yes.
And so we were building clunky old dashboards in BI. We were managing the back-end database. One of my earliest tasks as the manager of that team was to go on a report hunt and start culling the ridiculous level of reporting procreation that was happening. As well as trying to figure out, really, we should have standardized on either Cognos or BO. And I do remember changing my mind on a weekly basis and it becoming a running joke. And I'm pretty sure I left and we still had BO and Cognos. And it was dashboards, right? Cognos seemed a bit more modern with the whole OLAP cube thing. This is free, I guess... lurking in the background with stuff like Hadoop and distribution, but we have monolithic databases. I think some of them were on SQL Server. I can remember what the other database we had. And then like Informatica ETLs and shit like that. Oh, Jesus Christ. I don't know. It feels like, I feel slightly like I'm walking around an antique shop here. Like,
yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? It's like rooting through like an old vinyl collection or something. Oh, I remember that. That was kind of cool, but I'll never listen to that shit again. Oh, and it's all scratched. You know what I mean? Oh, you can't buy it anymore. So, yeah. There you go. So this back in the day was called MIS. And I do remember at some point there was sort of a manager above me who was in charge of sort of wider MIS office stuff. And he started using the term business intelligence. Around that point. So it started to creep in. I think we rebranded at some point from MIS to BI because he liked it. And this will have been 2002, 2004, something like that. So yeah, like it's been around and I've been around this block for a while. I mean, well, how far do you go back with this stuff?
Well, management information's back into the 90s because that's when I was actually building systems working at Safeway before it got taken over by Morrisons. And so, you know, MIS, well, funnily enough, was driven more by the finance team. And, you know, I was on supply chain and we're in depth automating the supply chain. It was all in-house built systems. So MIS was like, you know, That was not real at that point. And then it's funny you mentioned business objects because that might have come in at some point. That was sort of like, again, one of those memories where I thought, oh, that sounds familiar, but I can't remember where from. And then about the same time you were at lastminute.com, I was at AOL in the UK and interested
AOL.
In
AOL. Like
AOL, yes, remember
you were
those.
At the leading edge.
Yeah, CD, the CD-ROM, and then the actual sound of the, what's it called, you know, the...
Modem.
The modem. Yes, yeah, indeed. Oh, so yeah, that was all quite funny. And they, again, it sounds similar to where you were at last minute, so they had a whole in-house system which was monitoring all their web traffic and everything. And then there was, yeah, they were just beginning to introduce Omniture at that point and sort of moving from one system to another. So yeah, quite interesting. It was all the early days of web analytics, I guess.
And then I guess that's, you know, we're in the early 2000s. And I think after that, I went on a bit of a safari through all of tech, right? Delved in and out of digital and sort of BI type of analytics and analysis. And it's really hard for me to remember, but I sort of stopped doing so much with it, but would every now and again delve in and out. And at some point, found myself running a huge team of people doing digital analytics and having a team of people working for me who were doing data science. And I already had my Perl skills. I'd learned some Python along the way. And I remember I had this team of 30 people, the head of data at a big digital agency, thinking to myself, yeah, all I'm doing is hiring people and doing HR bureaucracy. I want to be doing what they're doing, staring longingly over at the data science team, and made that transition. And so I guess once I got into that, and that's when you and me first met, not that long after that, where Marks and Spencer's M&S, again, we were lurking in the area of data, distributed data, data science, and so on, but it wasn't BI, but BI was lurking, as it has been ever since. And you sort of can't get away from it. So I've sort of bounced in and out of it. I think while I was running that digital analytics team at the agency, we were reselling Tableau.
Yes.
And at that point, Tableau was the newish kid who was really disrupting things. And you had companies like Click in the background. I don't even know the history of Power BI. Was that an acquisition or something? I don't really know. But Power BI was not such a big player. Microsoft Power BI.
No. I think that's the big, that's what happened in that sort of going through the 2000s into the teens, is that by, 2015, there was a fairly standard set of tools, which is always up for change and new players coming in. But I guess what I mean by that is the idea that BI now had its own tool space was firmly there. Big data was getting well on the way. And so these were all things that were just now part of the architectural landscape and that you had to deliver and buy in if you're a big company with any sort of seriousness of data. So like you say, by 2015, there were a number of players. You had Tableau and Spotfire and Power BI. It was early or was someone else at that point. And it was fairly standard that a company would buy these stuff and get these tools. They know they would get dashboards, they'd get someone to build them for them. It was now becoming a well-trodden path to the point where people buy it and put it in, don't really know why they're doing it. It's just what they've been told to do by some consultant. And I think by the mid 2010s, that was well and trodden. I'm sure that's just a repeat of what was there 10 years earlier and what was there 10 years earlier. But I think what happens is it becomes more commonplace tools appear in the market. And then the more tools, the more it sort of legitimizes, this is what you need to do. And then just becomes a case of choose your tool rather than actually arguing whether you need it in the first place. So now, yes, you definitely have, management information. It's called BI. You'll get some tools with it. It's really easy to do. It's really cheap. You only spend $5 million with us and it's no problem. And all your company will be up and running and making data decisions in no time.
God, $5 million, yeah, right, very, very cheap. And I think that illustrates something about the whole thing, and a perennial issue that we have, partly in terms of what we do, but in general with analysis and reporting, and that tying the cost of something like BI directly back to revenue gained or cost saved or whatever it is your business case needs is often quite hard to do. And $5 million wasn't a ridiculous number. That's really the sort of
total cost of ownership that we were talking back then. And I actually don't know if that's dramatically changed. I think we've sort of delved in and out of this over the intervening years. And I think I got exposed to Click at some point and various other ones. And what were they running at M&S? They had a different one, didn't they? What was that?
That was did they not start doing Spotfire?
Spotfire, yeah, that was the one. So, I mean, we largely keep out of it because our business is a bit more deepy divey. And as much as sort of modern BI systems have the promise of top-level reporting and dashboards with drill down and data science capability and forecasting, the reality is sort of ish, you know, the drill down is available if someone's bothered to create that. The slice and dice capability in my mind seems to have got worse, but you can do some, you know, filtering and so on, depending on what the platform has set up. And then, you know, the data science capability still, you know, it's in R and Python and things. And if you don't have those skills, then you can't have them, but you can plug in various sort of predictive algorithms and stuff and do certain types of forecasting. But the problems of running these types of things don't go away, right? Forecasting is hard, whether or not it's easy to put on your screen or not. Getting a forecast that's reliable and trusted is difficult. The idea that you can just switch that on in Power BI is and always was nonsensical, although with the advent of stuff like Profit, certainly is slightly less nonsensical, but still problematic to extremes. So I think my perennial reaction with these little business intelligence dolphin moments are come up for air, have a look around at what's going on and look and go, oh my God, it's still fucking dashboards, right?
Yeah.
And what was it in 2002? Dashboards. And I had my issues with dashboards in 2002, and I have my issues with them now. And that they amount to something along the lines of, it's fine. We all need to know what the single version of the truth is with regards to, you know, revenue to date for this year, or, you know, margin or something. You know, there's some stable state metrics, sales numbers, throughput, whatever you want, that you kind of do need a North Star on, right? In a way that's called a stable and that everyone can access. And everyone knows if you go to this number, then you are looking at the right number, right? And that might cascade down to other departments. So, but they're very backwards looking. And the capability to drill down, although to a degree is available, is often lost on most users. And I think that, you know, every time you have a need to explore further in a piece of data because, oh, sales went down, why? And if it's not obvious why, then how do I use the data to do that? Well, the chances of the cut of data that you need to do that, even if you're able to sort of infer what that might be, it probably isn't available, right? The cuts that are available are probably related to problems that you had 6 months ago, right? And now you don't look at the reports that you had built so you could track that going forward, because once you're tracking it, the chances are you're remediating it, right? And so from the point of view of running a business and making decisions, I don't think many people are making decisions off the back of looking at dashboards. And I think most people just don't look at them. And your ability to make decisions is almost always exception orientated, right? Something has happened in the world that means that you need to take an action on something. And if number go down, well, why has it gone down? And how can I take a decision on what to do about that if I don't know why it happened? And so, I've got conversion and blah, blah, blah. I know that. I see the number. I see the chart. but you're not telling me anything, right? Even if you've given me a forecast, I still don't understand how to react to that. And the idea that you can then just have a system that people will automatically know how and how to navigate that particular problem, because it can be a billion things, right? And so at that point, dashboards are like, well, why do we have these? And I get why we have them. But if you are spending $5 million on dashboards, right, I would call into question the value for money, right?
Yeah.
And so every time I resurface and see more dashboards, I'm like, nothing has changed. Oh, but they're better dashboards. Who gives a shit, right? I mean, they're still, it's a flawed principle.
Yeah.
Feel free to disagree with me on that.
No, I mean, I think, yeah, he was highlighting that in the podcast as well, in the fact that, what did he say? It was like a 40% penetration in terms of people on the ground in companies that might be making decisions. Did they have access to the information they needed? It was only 40%. And I think that what that tells you is you can have all the tools you like, but if they're not proving useful to people, they're not really going to use them, and they're not going to, you know, push for more information through them. And then, as you say, because things get tricky and complicated, people find other ways around it, you know, in the heat of the moment. And then that doesn't really encourage the use of the information you do have via the dashboards you do have. So you end up going, oh, well, I found it out this way. And then that becomes your new way of solving it, or, well, now the problem's solved and I'll just go back to how it was. And even if you did go back and look at your dashboard, it has the blip on it, and now it's just telling you the same thing every week. So, I think you're right. They don't tell you anything useful except for when there's an exception. And then when there is the exception, I mean, they can be vaguely informative, but invariably you're going to need more information.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of what we do, right?
Yeah.
It's our most basic level. Your dashboard isn't going to give you that, and therefore come and have a chat with us and we'll help you figure that out. And we are worth 5 million, Pete. You know me?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think more than 5 million, right? What we are not really configured to do is distribution, right? And scaled distribution. And it's arguable, our trade occupies a different sort of space of the data and information spectrum that has a small level of overlap, right? And we can distribute, but it's almost certainly the type of work we're doing is a bit more specialized. And if we do create something that, has broad appeal across a business, or that, you know, the CEO needs everyone to see daily, then of course it can then be pushed out via Tableau or Power BI. But again, you know, I think we always feel a little bit deflated when that happens, because, you know, isn't yet another piece of data to go stale. And people's answer to everything seems to be, oh, I have a problem with this, let's get a cell in the dashboard for it, right? And half of the reports or the dashboards that you see are just stale or useless or pointless at best, and a distraction at worst. And I've been in and out of this industry for 20 years. I think for 15 of those, I've been saying you need to move to an exception based model, right?
Yeah.
Essentially, the system tells you when there's a thing that it needs to draw your attention to, and then draws your attention to it. And we'll come back to the AI side of this in a little while. But I think that exception-based reporting has been feasible for a lot longer than the LLMs have been around.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sitting here just moaning. There are solutions to this problem. I don't think they're perfect. And some of them are organizational. And we're not going to get into the whole Amazon WBR thing, the weekly business review thing. I think go back to episode 5 or something of this, and there's a whole big chat about that. So there's obviously a cultural aspect to this, but let's stick with the technology for the moment. But dashboards, right? It's still dashboards. It's basically it. So that is the state of the union. And let's have a quick look at my industry data. So Microsoft Power BI dominates 30% share among business users. So the 40% of business users that need it, that are using it, 30% of those are using Power BI. Tableau's in second place. Click is a bit of a niche player. SAP. Oh, there you go. SAP Business Objects. Oh, my God. Business Objects swallowed up by SAP.
Of course.
Oh, my God. The horror show. The horror show.
Yes.
Let's do an episode on SAP, Pete. Can we do it? Can we? Right. SAP, the cancer of the modern business. Okay. So I think it's still used. That's absolutely bonkers. Looker is gaining traction post its Google acquisition.
Oh, yeah.
So Tableau, 17%. Salesforce with Tableau, 14.8%. And Click is about 10%. So yeah. That's our roster of key BI players. I was sort of surprised to duck away and then resurface. It didn't feel like very long after to see that Microsoft had just swallowed everything up, right? I guess I shouldn't be that surprised because that's what they do. But 100,000 organizations, 30 million active monthly users using Power BI.
Wow.
Which is nuts.
Yeah.
Nuts. And it's okay, isn't it? Power BI is fine. I mean,
it's sort of extension works nicely with Excel, which is kind of good. So it feels like a natural extension of that.
Yeah, I just sort of felt myself sinking reading all of that. And again, it has its place. But so every business of any size, and mostly we work in bigger businesses, have one of those. What's missing off here is the king of them all, which is Excel, which comes up in the interview with Mr. Dresner. if you stuck Excel on this list and told me then I had to name my favorite, it would be Excel, right? Yeah. Excel is my favorite BI tool. It's also my least favorite, right? That's a fact, right? I get less cold chills when I see Excel than I do when I see Power BI, because Excel is like just the Swiss Army knife of data tools. And I've got a lot of respect for what started out being a piece of accounting productivity software that's now used for keeping notes on your cat's feeding schedule, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And you can actually plug Python into Excel cells now, right?
Yes.
But it's horrific in terms of distribution, because everyone's got their own copy of everything. But it's been there. It's like an old friend. So you can't take Excel out of this picture. And I sort of suppose you've got to add in the likes of Databricks and Snowflake, and even to an extent, Jupyter-based solutions, in terms of their ability to do some level of distribution. But I wouldn't seriously say if you wanted to replace your Power BI stack right now, you would just plug in Databricks, not from a distribution perspective, absolutely. I would put Databricks in place of the whole Power Stack, but then I would replace all Microsoft basically everywhere. So I'm probably the wrong person to ask. So that's where we are. How does that feel? How's that feel to you as a state of the world?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of tools. I think same old problem. A fool with a tool is still a fool. Whilst the tools provide in their implementation a certain amount of plumbing that's required in order to see business information, I always feel it's just not enough. I don't feel like giving somebody just the information and a tool that they can manipulate it is particularly helpful if I really know what to do with it. And then invariably people get busy, and whilst these tools are, you know, semi-intuitive, you get the most out of them when you've got a bit more experience with them, and that just takes time. And I'm not sure that, you know, like, I'm not sure everyone wants to be a power user. You know, you have the same issue with Excel. You know, people use it with varying degrees of expertise, but if you wanted to start getting some useful numbers out and regularly that people can rely on, you usually have to go to someone on the team that's got a bit of now. So you have to spend a bit of time yourself, you know, working through it. It's not something you can pull up in 10, 15 minutes and then go, yeah, and we can all look at this forever and a day, although no, no, that happens as well. But and I think it's always the same with these tools. There's a certain amount of investment of time that everybody needs, and not everybody has that time to give.
Yeah, you've got to come and talk to us. And also this stuff is just not that simple, right? That's why we have jobs, right?
Yeah.
And you'd think that 20 years ago, well, and the rest, the BI systems have been around. If they were going to replace us, they would have done by now, right? So
yeah.
Power BI is not going to replace you, Pete. But what's going to replace you is ChatGPT or perhaps Claude, right?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously. And so I've been doing some proof of concepts recently for a client that use fairly significant elements of Gen AI, LLMs, within dashboard stroke notebook like environment. I've actually been using Marimo, but I'm going to move on to something else. But this allowed me to do, for example, here is a chart, just summarize it and draw attention to the key features. Here is the top line data for this organization. Summarize it in three bullets, drawing attention to the main features. Here is a chat box. A chat box? I do mean a chat box, right? A box where you can chat to an LLM, which has visibility over the underlying data via a data frame. In this case, it was Polars. And ask questions. So give me revenue by week, filtered down by customers in the Northeast region, etc. Right? And it will just produce that table for you. And then you can say, time series, please. Right? And it will give you a time series. So I did that. It didn't take long. Right? And so AI, Gen AI, LLMs definitely have a role to play here. Right?
Yeah.
And does this get us to our exception-based view of the world? It could. But now I start to think about this problem in terms of two things. One is self-serve and the other one is exceptions, right? I don't think dashboards disappear. I just think they become far less numerous and far more focused on very, very stable delivery of numbers in a very, very stable way. You know, your North Star, this is the revenue number. If you have another number, you're wrong, right? So that's dashboards gone. Just over the side there. And so we have self-service versus exception. And I think in terms of the work that I've been doing, I've been accounting for the self-service side with that chat box, right? That self-service has always been hard because in BI systems, you're constrained by what's been made available. And, you know, people don't understand how to change, how to translate the need that's in their mind into some instructions or drop down filters or whatever in some other tool. But they might be able to write them down in the English language, right? And they might be able to do it in such a way that a model can understand and give them the right numbers. Now, anyone listening to that would have spotted like an Everest-sized mountain of flaws to my argument and caveats, but we can at least agree that there is some there is a path to doing that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's the ultimate, it's almost the ultimate tool. If that worked, you know, ask question in language I'm familiar with, get answer exactly with actual figures that answers that query specifically with no misinterpretation.
Oh, did you manage to pick up on some of the flaws in my argument there by any chance?
Yes.
So I was giving the model real numbers that were verified, right? And the model can either get its interpretation of that right or wrong. But you've got a bit more control there. The moment it's a chat box and it's self-service for a user, the model won't be doing the calculation on the data. It never sees the data, right? It just ferries back, in this example, SQL queries, right? So if you want that, you have to, you know, join these tables and aggregate on that column and blah, blah, blah. And if you want a chart, it's probably doing some, you're passing back some matplotlib code. All this gets seamlessly run in the background by the notebook or whatever it is and visualize, right? Rock and roll. Hurrah, we've done it. We've solved BI, right? Except it's quite conceivable, A, to ask a question that's meaningless, given the data, or for B, for the model to return stuff that looks right, but is complete nonsense, right? Mm-hmm. By creating a completely valid query that is meaningless, right? Use the wrong column, you know, didn't filter it properly, just forgot a filter that was obvious from what you'd said and so on. You know, we all know what they do, right? And herein lies the Everest level caveat, is that how do we get from a point where it's actually easy to set up a chatbot versus, you know, chatbot based BI interface, but getting it to report numbers, you know, consistently accurately might be impossible. You know what I mean? And that's where we are.
Yeah.
And you, as a person who spends a lot of his time testing these models, must be very, very painfully accurate, but painfully aware of that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, you just get into this whole myriad of, you know, possible places where it can go wrong. And I think that I get most twitchy, like you say, when you talk about self-service, as in, you know, you've got all the people in your company asking any sort of question, and also their interpretation of the answer. And at this point, I start to really worry, which is the subject of another podcast, I think, around when these things are going to be useful, and I think when they're not useful is exactly this situation, is one size fits all, and I think that's where it's not useful. And I'd have a discussion about that at some point, because I think this is where it's going to go. The LLMs are too good a useful tool not to plug in here, but in terms of them being a tool for everybody, yeah, I think you still have the same problems. You still have the same issue of, was the right question being asked? Was it interpreted the right way? Is the right data used as the answer? I don't, you know, these don't necessarily change it. There might be some, you know, a bunch of mid query, you know, stuff in the middle that they answer. And like you say, you can ferry around the SQL and stuff. And I think that's probably quite good. And so what is that doing for you? Well, you're removing a layer of people that have to write SQL for you. And within certain parameters, I think that's probably true. I think, you know, 90% of that can probably be done. But is it not the edge cases which make this? And, you know, and that's where I think we really run into trouble again. So I think there's a, you know, it starts to become very, very fraught as to whether having an LLM is in the mix is gonna help or make things markedly worse.
Well, and as ever, there are tolerances around accuracy in terms of how problematic or how much the end user is going to struggle with 5% error rates, for example. And also, not all errors are created equal. And I think we go back to the, you know, why do we need BI? Well, we need BI to take action, to make decisions. And so I can self-serve, go and ask, why did number go down? It gives me an answer. That answer seems ridiculously plausible. It's given me some other data to back that up. And I take a decision, right, I'm gonna, you know, sack a quarter of my workforce, right? Turns out the data it gave you was plausible nonsense, right? And actually the right answer was in, you know, employ 10% more people or something, right? And business goes under, everyone gets laid off. It turns out that business was Microsoft, the world ends, right? So I'm being slightly flippant here, but like making bad decisions can end businesses. Now, if you're consulting a language model to ask questions of data and you make a business threatening decision off the back of that, then perhaps you shouldn't have been in that position in the first place. But lots of smaller decisions are going to get made, and some of those could be quite damaging, right? Perhaps on a slightly less macro level. And that shit's going to add up. And 5%, if that's your number, might not seem a lot, but that could be business threatening, right? The wrong 5% of wrong decisions is apocalyptic, right? So, I mean, it's an issue I'm dealing with right now in terms of, you know, because there's no, that I've seen, there's no viable provider, existing incumbent software provider providing anything like this, probably for the same reasons. And whether or not, how far down that route I can go in terms of providing stuff, because you can always just effectively create some sort of MCP style wrapper where really the types of query are sort of limited. So it's a bit like a dashboard behind a chatbot with probably a bit more stuff, right? But that we know that everything that thing can return is validated data, right?
Yeah.
And I think at this point, that's the only thing anyone can claim to be able to do.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's some value here as well, because we have to remember that the reason you want to use data to make decisions is because you want to challenge the bias that people have. We're taking holistic views with things, and you want to challenge that with, you know, what's going on in the real world. And I could see, you know, and so one of the problems people have is they'll see a number and it doesn't agree with the model they've got in their head. And rather than, oh, right, I must be wrong, or I'll change the model, it's, oh, well, your number must be wrong, which is a valid pushback. Equally, there's a good pushback here, which is, no, number is right. You've got to change your model. And yeah, this is the point of having, you know, BI systems. So I can see a role here for a LLM to sit in the middle and say, oh, well, here's your number. You know, I'll pull those figures back for you. My analysis says these numbers are doing this. And you go, well, that's not the way I read it. I think it's this. And it says, well, okay, look, I'll pull these numbers over here for you. And this backed up my argument. Oh, no, you're absolutely right. Maybe what I missed was this. So I think a conversational exploration, I think, might even be more useful, where, you know, you're getting it to produce the figures, which is hands off. And so it's using tools to do that. But then it does have a sort of, you know, a view on it, some analysis on it, having provided the numbers, I now think this. And then you have a conversation, because you do want to push people out of, you know, their predetermined thinking. So, you know, perhaps there's a role there. But again,
well, we kind of described our role, haven't you, Eve, though, right? So
yeah,
ultimately, we often say things to the business they don't want to hear.
Yeah.
If we're gonna have to do that, we always do our homework and make sure that we really do mean that, right? Because, you know, you don't want to piss the business users off and then go, oh, sorry, no, that wasn't right. The number was actually going up, not down. And part of what we do as a job is having a good sense of what's right and what's not, what the data yields and whether or not it's yielding the right flavor of things, whether things are in the right ballpark and we can spot bullshit from a mile off, right? Mm-hmm. And it is a conversational enterprise, right? What we do is conversational. What the model doesn't lack the conversational ability, it lacks the interrogational ability, the cynicism, the critical facets, and has a tendency to want to please, right? And part of the job we have to do is say, well, look, you might not like this, but this is the reality that we're in. Whereas, you know, models might well just go, okay, you didn't like that, so here's a number that you do like, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think it's that. So I think as a product, I think if you think about AI and BI, AI plus BI, as in terms of like co-pilot-ish, a wrapper around the sorts of stuff that we already do in notebooks and stuff, as a productivity tool for analysts, BI analysts and data scientists, then assuming that those people have the right training and instincts around the data, then we're in a really good state. Putting it directly then in the hands of the end user right now, I mean, please tell me if I'm wrong, anyone out there, but this sounds nuts to me. I think that's where we are, right? That's the state of it. It's still dashboards. There is a way out of this, but it's not going to be, it's not going to be a smooth journey.
No. Yeah, and I think that feels right. And I think it's not necessarily clear, you know, what the way is out right now. And there are definitely some elements that can be used, but the success of those will really define, you know, where we are in a few years' time.
Yes, I think that's right. I mentioned a lot of exception-based stuff there as well. And I think the models can help with this, again, to a degree. But there's a lot more data science rigor that needs to go on behind the scenes for that. I'd like to do a conversation on a sort of exception-based, data reporting at some point. I'd be interested to find someone who's a bit more au fait with, anomaly detection and stuff in data. I wonder if we can track someone down to come and talk to us about that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, there's so much more here, but I think we've done a state of the BI.
Yeah.
State of the BI world. That was exhausting, and the technical issues nearly killed me. The listeners won't be aware because it'll be removed in the edit, but we had to stop recording halfway through because my computer problems became so bad I had to reboot. And it looks like the culprit was and still is iCloud. So screw iCloud. iCloud is dead to me. That's why you probably felt the energy levels dip a bit about halfway through. Because that was not fun. I'm going to do one little bonus feature at the end here because I think it's just quite interesting. So do you remember, did you ever encounter MicroStrategy as a BI software along your travels?
No, only vaguely. I mean, it sounds familiar. Might come back to me.
I don't know if I ever actually used it. I was aware that it was one of the players at some point. And then I started hearing about this company that people in the finance world talk about called Strategy. Used to be called MicroStrategy, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, MicroStrategy are a BI tool. why are you talking about it in terms of cryptocurrency? So I figured this one out. Here's a potted history. It was founded in 1989, and it was a business and intelligence company. You know, usual dashboards, known for solid, dependable, scalable BI solutions. Built a customer base in finance, retail, healthcare, other big industries. Before, at some point in early 2020, the CEO, Michael Saylor, S-A-Y-L-O-R, decides, he's a bit of a, Ada describes him here as flamboyant.
MicroStrategy was once a respectable enterprise analytics firm, decent software, sensible cloud services. Then their flamboyant CEO, Michael Saylor, lost his bloody mind and instead of playing the analytics game, decided that Bitcoin was the answer to everything. Since 2020, the stubborn bastard doubled down hardcore, dumping over $3 billion of company cash and debt, because why not, into Bitcoin, like some tech junkie chasing a crypto hit. The result? Stock took a calf kicking while Bitcoin's price rode the mental roller coaster. When crypto winters came, MicroStrategy's balance sheet got shredded, debt ballooning, goodwill impairments nuked earnings, and all sorts of watered-down financial horrors. Investors felt like they'd backed the wrong horse, ticked off with hot garbage. The buy-the-dip strategy they touted started sounding crazier the deeper Bitcoin plunged. They're basically Tesla for crypto enthusiasts. Minus the sexy electric cars, just a dude hugging billions of dollars worth of digital gold and dragging shareholders through every gut-wrenching crash cycle. Bottom line, MicroStrategy turned itself from a sane software firm into a Bitcoin exposure vehicle, piling risk like an idiot flirting with financial suicide. Some cheer for the billionaire vision. I just see one hell of a cautionary tale about corporate recklessness and obsession.
CEO Michael Taylor, via MicroStrategy, buys his first $250,000 worth of Bitcoin, right? And then throughout 20 and 21, aggressively piles in spending billions more via equity and debt, eventually getting 124,000 Bitcoins, which is more than the value of the whole earth, right? An average of $30,000 each. Late 2021, Bitcoin peaks. MicroStrategy's Bitcoin stash was worth north of $5 billion. Crypto market tanks in 2022, so he loses a load of money. 2022 onward, Saylor steps down as CEO but stays executive chairman. Bitcoin buybacks occur. Current state, company acts more like a Bitcoin holding firm than a software company, riding crypto's madness with nerves threaded and investors twitchy. It's really being held up as a sort of the first example of a business that now is entirely based on its ability to buy, hold, and trade Bitcoin, and only Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
And so it's got a revenue of 450-ish million, net income of 4.85 billion. Bloody a price to earnings ratio 23.28. It's like this Bitcoin behemoth that on the whim of the CEO just transformed from a rather boring business intelligence company to like a big gambling firm, which is what it is when it boils down to it. And this is a public company. So effectively, it's a way of proxy buying Bitcoin. So if you buy shares in Strategy, you're ultimately buying Bitcoin, right? Or
yeah.
I guess it depends. You could be seen as gambling on the price of Bitcoin.
Yeah,
And so it's become a really weird financial entity that when you hear finance people talking about it, they think it's a head scratcher, right? And it's just wild. It's just wild that this business, just in a matter of like 2 years, just completely transformed itself. And it's not actually clear to me from any of this whether MicroStrategy still, you know, supports software. But
yeah,
there you go.
I thought on the hedge, didn't they cover some other, I I'm going to say it was Japanese, but I thought there was some noodle bars or something, which some guy was running a noodle bar and did the same, started buying Bitcoin. And the next thing you know, they're a Bitcoin company. And
so you're talking about the Unhedged podcast and newsletter from the Financial Times. We talk about it quite a lot, but they have covered strategy on there. And the noodle bar people effectively, as far as I understand it, just copied strategy. From what I can gather, this was the first company to do this on any meaningful scale. Certainly, it sounds like the first company that just completely pivoted their whole business model. So, you know, BI does have a use. You can take BI companies and turn them into Bitcoin behemoths.
Exactly.
So that's the real state of BI in 2025.
Yeah.
Right.
There we go. On that note.
There you go. Right. Yeah, I don't want to talk about BI next week. We were supposed to talk about AI and creativity this week, but we had so much fun recording that episode and various things we did as part of it or to prepare for it. And we managed to not talk about anything close to what we wanted to talk about. So it's going to make an appearance in the coming weeks, and I can't tell you when, as a multimedia extravaganza, including video and AI-generated portions, and at least two episodes. Maybe it'll just be two. If we're sensible, it'll just be two. So watch out for that. It might surface by next week, the first bit of it, but if not, I'm definitely not going to talk about BIP. Can we do something else, please?
Yes, for sure.
Okay, good. We'll come back to BI at some other point, right? Actually, next week's episode, Alex moans about technical problems for an hour and a half.
Mm.
Go and enjoy your technology. I'm going to go and sit in a field away from it.
Speak soon. Cheers. Bye.
The Confusion Matrix. Confusion.